on the Empire Podcast this week, we have a real pair of acting heavyweights as Mr. Sean Penn drops by to finally prove that he really is mightier than Chef Sword, while Sir Ben Kingsley comes along and brings a couple of his friends with him. All that and more on the movie podcast that simply cannot unsee the Randy Quaid sex tape. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Now, every week for the past 3 years, I've introduced these guys by highlighting one facet of their multifaceted personalities and riffing endlessly on it. But a regular podcast listener pointed out that there must be more to Ali Plum than knowing obscure film facts. There must be more to Phil Dissemblian than being an art house guru. And there must be more to Helen O'Hara than an unhealthy obsession with Supernatural's Winchester Brothers. So, Ali and Helen are here today. So tell me about yourselves. Give me something that I can spin out for the next 100 episodes.
I got nothing. I feel like my entire personality, apart from loving the Winchesters, well, Dean, has been erased by this process, you know, over 150-some episodes.
Uh-huh.
Everything else has just vanished like dust on the wind.
See? It's difficult.
Helen has shoes that are so sparkly, they look like petrol sheen.
I do have a lot of sparkly shoes. This is something we may not have talked about on the podcast before. Yes.
I don't know if I can spin that out. I don't know if that's something I can use over 100.
With Cinderella next week, it seems like it should be a thing that would work for you, Chris, no?
Yeah, Cinderella worked for me. Do you have any glass slippers?
No, I don't. I tried a pair, but I find them a little bit unyielding and uncomfortable.
Okay. How about Perspex pumps?
I do, actually.
You do have a pair of Perspex pumps. Peter Piper picked a pack of Perspex pumps. Ali, let's boil you down to...
The popping on that is going to be terrible.
I know. I apologize, but let's see if we can do it. Peter Piper picked a pair of Perspex pumps. How many pumps of Perspex... Fuck. Ali! Let's boil you down to one defining characteristic.
I was thinking you could ask me about Plug Alert, the 1990s TV shows I've been watching recently.
Yay!
Because I watch a lot of 1990s TV shows, situation comedies, dramas, gladiators. And I have a rival podcast which is set to overtake Empire's many millions of listeners.
Many millions.
With almost up to a dozen people listening at any one time.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just put in mind of Airplane. So, tell me, Joey, do you like movies about gladiators?
I do like reality TV show competitions about them. Yeah, so, you know, I do that. Chris may himself be appearing on one sometime soon.
Ooh.
Yeah, so you could ask me what I have been watching recently.
So that's what you want me to do from now on?
Sure.
So ask Helen about shoes.
Shoes.
And you about TV programs.
TV programs.
This has not been as successful as I was hoping. But okay, no worries. Let's move on then. We have questions, as ever, on the podcast. People have been sending in, usually via Twitter, and that's no exception this week. At DavidStreet76, I'm sure he's been on the podcast before, asks, which film have you owned more copies of than any other? It's The Omen for me, says David. 7 copies from the TV copy to the Blu-ray steelbook. Well done, David.
I think for me it might be Speed, because
the film,
the
or
film,
you're not confessing,
yeah, no, I'm
to
not
a collection
confessing
of,
to a drug problem.
Okay,
no.
18 copies of a drug.
18 copies. Yes,
that would be a lot of copies. No, I think it might be Speed, because I bought it originally on VHS, uh-huh, and then obviously I started upgrading my collection to DVD. But I'm not very methodical about it, as you know, because you get upset that I, you know, file my DVDs by spine color.
Yes.
And so for a long time, I couldn't quite remember if I had already upgraded Speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought like 2 more copies of it on DVD.
Just to make sure.
Well, I thought that I was buying them for the first time. And then I obviously bought it on Blu-ray because it's Speed. So you need it.
I don't have it.
What is wrong with you?
I don't have it.
You have it on HD DVD.
Yes, I backed the wrong horse. That's pound that one in the ground. Yes, I did. I got rid of them though. I got rid of all my HD DVDs. I moved house recently.
And then you went clay pigeon shooting. Paul!
That would have been infinitely more satisfying than what I did, which is I have some to send to readers, which I haven't done yet. And I gave the rest to Dan for his dad, who apparently has never forgiven Dan for recommending HD DVD over Blu-ray. So he sat with this useless monolith, and I donated my monolith to the local dump.
I actually wrote a piece this week for a rival publication.
Oh,
not a
come
magazine.
On now.
No, like a paper, so it's different. But about VHS and how VHS collecting continues to be a big thing. in some parts of the world. And there are people out there who have and are growing enormous VHS collections. So there's stuff that still isn't loaded, a lot of stuff that still never got transferred to DVD, and right. and it stands at risk of being lost forever. So there's a massive and growing VHS movement. I wouldn't say massive, like it's not as big as the vinyl movement, because like vinyl obsessives genuinely think that vinyl is better.
Yes.
And even VHS obsessives don't think
that VHS you can't make that
really
argument.
Better,
you no. really can't.
But they do think it's worth preserving, and I think having talked to a bunch of them this week, hello Viva VHS, if you're talking.
Oh,
if you're
hello.
Listening. I think there's, you know, there's something to be said for it.
Yes, but VHS is massive. It's huge.
Yeah, yeah it is.
You know. I used to use them as like kind of Lego blocks. Make a little house out of them.
You could do that.
I've done it.
Well, you can do that, but apparently if you keep them against the outer walls of your house, you're at much higher risk of developing VHS mold, and you don't want tape mold, so you have to keep them on inner walls.
Inner walls.
Inner walls.
That's amazing.
Today's top tip on the Empire Podcast, keep your VHSs on an inner wall.
What film do you want more copies of than any other?
Not surprisingly, it's The Big Lebowski, which I have on VHS. I have it on the DVD that I think everyone knows it as. Then I have it on the DVD cover that has the alternate poster where it's them sitting on a sofa, mm-hmm. the green toe's there in front of them. Her life was in their hands, now her toe is in the mail. That's the line on the front. Then I got a Coen Brothers box set, then I got another Coen Brothers box set because they were compiling different ones. And then I got the Blu-ray re-release, and I'm still looking out for the bowling ball release where it's Ooh. An actual DVD. I think it's not the Blu-ray, I think it's still the DVD, which is actually inside a small Jesus bowling ball, purple bowling ball.
That's pretty cool.
Which you unlock like you would, say, a Kinder Egg.
That's pretty cool.
Smash it and then eat the pieces.
You pop it in your mouth and you squeeze it a bit and then you take it out again.
On a slightly related topic, who's your favourite Coen brother?
Gary.
Gary Coen.
No, it's Phil. It's Phil.
nicely sidestepped. Helen, who's your favourite Coen brother?
Ethan.
Ethan.
I typed for him.
You typed him?
I typed him.
He's okay. Not real. Helen is writing him right now.
Oh my God.
How about you?
I don't think it's going to come. Coen Brothers?
Yeah.
No, Joel, because he's like, he rocks the ponytail, which men of his age generally shouldn't do, but he manages to get away with it. Right. The one that I have owned most copies of than any other, have a guess what it's going to be.
Evil Dead
is
Evil 2, Dead. Yes.
Yes, Noah's Tree of Wooden Clogs. I have it on VHS, Laserdisc, Betamax. I have the Tree of Wooden Clogs DVD box set, which was actually a tree of wooden clogs with that you opened up to get the... No.
I have it on Tapestry.
Tapestry is the best way to own.
The wax cylinder version of The Big Lebowski.
No, it's Evil Dead 2. It's Evil Dead 2. I had on VHS, I used to go to VHS fairs and pick up like horror films for like.
So cool.
Roll on up. And we have horror galore.
And it was one of the first ones I ever bought. That's where I think I saw it for the first time, actually. I bought it, you know, I was like, oh, Evil Dead 2. I've never seen this. And I bought it and loved it. I've had it obviously on DVD. I have a limited edition DVD tin, which doesn't fit into my DVD shelf, which is really annoying. And I have, at the moment, 3 Blu-ray versions of it. But I also have 3 Blu-ray versions at the moment, and I don't really know why, of Hot Fuzz. I have a steelbook, I have the traditional release, and then I have it as part of the Three Flavors Cornetto box set. I might watch them all one day. Just
do it.
See if they differ in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, I've got the Omen quite a lot as well. I've got the Omen box set, but I also have the Omen on Blu-ray. I also had the Omen on DVD, and so on and so forth. But yeah, 7 copies, David Street. Wow. Amazing. Here's another very, very quick one from at Rick Usuakas, and I am so sorry if I've mangled that. He says, a meteor the size of Texas is hurtling towards Earth. Oh, wait, no, it's hypothetical. You have time to save only one film studio because that would be the priority. which one do you save?
Okay, first of all, we all know from watching, I think it was Deep Impact and or Armageddon, that a meteor the size of Texas is going to wipe out everything. That's too big. So I think actually he has missized his meteor here. That is an extinction level event, an LE.
But you don't realize that he's actually taking the studio and putting it into a spaceship.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Well, yeah. Now that does put a different complexion on things.
Well,
but
now
then,
we're talking.
Hang on, who's going to watch it? Because everybody's going to be wiped out.
Not everyone.
Are we all on spaceships as well?
Of course we're all on spaceships.
It's like WALL-E.
Okay, so it's women and film journalists first, is it? That's who's going to be saved when the planet.
That's right.
Because destroyed.
We don't see the world in those terms, Helen. Film journalists first.
Save
yes, journalists absolutely.
First. Save the CEOs, then the hairdressers and the estate agents.
We're going to need property deals on our new planet, guys.
And we're always going to have to look good. So the hairdressers, definitely. Film journalists, okay.
Telephone
essential.
Sanitizers, get on board.
This is a very weird apocalypse. Okay.
Monkeys and organ grinders.
So here's for me the big question. I mean, I have to say, you know, at the risk of being self-parody, you know, my first answer would be Disney, because then you get Star Wars and Marvel and Pixar as part of the deal. But I'm wondering, could they sort of save themselves? Because they're quite, you know, big and they have all those superheroes and stuff, so maybe they'd be okay.
You know, Walt has a red button that turns the castle into a rocket ship, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Disneyland would probably be... They'd probably just save themselves. I wouldn't have to worry about them.
Yeah.
So really, it's about the others.
Because, of course, that star that goes over the castle is actually just a warning sign.
Beep. I mean, Universal has my beloved Fast and Furious and Pitch Perfect.
That's why you're saving Universal.
Okay. I mean, forget Psycho. We'll have none of that.
Okay. What? Those
Jaws.
Are the most important things.
All right. Yeah.
Oh, wait, so we're looking at back catalogue and not just everything going forward.
I'm looking at the lot. I'm looking at physically the lot. And I think if you had to save a lot, it would be Universal. Mm-hmm. If it was a back catalogue, I think Warner's and Paramount both have humongous things. Disney, like you say, is just gargantuan. But we're ignoring Asylum, aren't we? Because, I mean, they would be very small to pick up. I mean, it's someone's laptop, isn't it? No. So we'd just take that, I'd put that in my rucksack, then we'd be in space, and then we could watch movies and make them for so little money. Disney don't know how to make cheap movies, do they?
Why would we want to save Asylum? Why?
Sharknado 3 is coming out, and its subtitle is Oh Hell No. And it kind of doesn't rhyme. And it's got the Hoff in it. So we need to save all of that.
I'm actually astonished that the Hoff wasn't in the first two. I'm not entirely sure if
you
don't
think he called up his agent
frame
and just
by
said,
frame.
Why am I not in these films?
Yes.
Yeah. I like bad movies. You know that about me. But I watched the first Sharknado and I couldn't get behind this phenomenon. I'm sorry. So I'm gonna veto that. Mm. That's just out.
There's a video interview with Stephen Merchant interviewing a couple of the cast members of Zombieva. Mm-hmm. And they discuss why Sharknado is a terrible film. And the reason why is because zombie and beaver share a syllable, B, whereas shark and tornado share nothing.
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
The whole premise is flawed.
That's why the premise is flawed, all
Sharknado.
Right.
Sharknado. Just doesn't work.
Why wasn't it like Sharkwind or Whirl Shark? I'd see a film called Whirl Shark, wouldn't you?
I hope not.
No? Or, you know...
Let's just all acknowledge that the insane straight-to-DVD shark genre peaked with Shark Attack 3.
Yes.
Like, I think we can all agree on that.
But
and
you
everything
will...
since then, and this is a big hello to the Forumites, by the way, who I know are big fans of that movie. I just don't think that they had anywhere else to go after that, you know?
Well, apart from my Kickstarter, which is, of course, Whalewind, which is really going to... upend the whole genre of tornado-based
marine
swimming
life forms,
aquatic folk.
And this is the sort of film that would be saved if we could
yes,
save
that's correct.
Film.
So I think we've answered your question.
Yeah, I think
that's Chris,
it.
Who would you save?
I honestly don't know. I really don't know. I mean, yes, because like Helen, I'm increasingly becoming a self-parody. I would save Marvel, obviously. But I don't know. Fox... Who doesn't
Fox.
Love Fox? Who doesn't have a thrill when they hear the Fox fanfare? And who wouldn't want Rupert Murdoch to be on the spaceship with us all?
Yeah. You know it's his spaceship, right?
It's his spaceship. Who wouldn't want that?
And if we're talking back catalogs, doesn't Sony own MGM?
Sony does own MGM,
so
yes.
So that's a hell of a back catalog.
But then, Helen, the Bond movies would be wiped out.
Yeah,
so
oh,
that would be,
shame.
You know, there they go.
Oh.
But then again, as a movie lover, which I hope we all are on this movie podcast, there's an other thrill I get when I see the Universal logo or when I see the Warner's shield, you know, especially from the 70s when it was that really cool, funky little thing. It was just like a logo. It wasn't even the shield. You know, so,
that W with the dot, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, do you really want
to... So what we're saying, okay, what
all
we actually
the studios.
Need to, yeah, leave the rest of the planet behind, focus on all the studios and the indies.
Yes.
And, like, you know, let's get some international film up in there as well.
It's really tough. Which is the studio behind Armageddon, because we'd obviously have to save them.
Yes, they've got expertise that might come in handy.
Yes, they absolutely do. The name of your shark, Windy Shark movie, should be Hurricane Carcaridan Carcaridis.
Starring?
Kim Kardashian?
Kim Kardashian. I'm doing well with the tongue twisters this week. Our first guest this week. Oh, wait, no. How do you get in touch? Because that's important. If you want to get in touch with the Empire Podcast, and why wouldn't you? After we do unspeakable things to your questions, you can Twitter us. We're at Empire Magazine on the twits, and the hashtag is Empire Podcast. And you can Facebook us, Empire Magazine. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Our first guest this week is one of Britain's greatest actors, a chameleon who won he's not an actual chameleon, he has chameleonic tendencies, who won an Oscar in 1982 for playing Gandhi. By that, I mean he doesn't cling to branches and change.
Got you.
Just blend it with the background. Anyway, since then, he's sketched unforgettable character after unforgettable character. He is, of course, Sir Ben Kingsley, who will be next seen in next week's Robot Overlords. He popped in this week to talk to Phil Dissemblian and myself, and he brought a couple of those unforgettable characters with him. It's quite a treat. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of Robot Overlords and the toast of Croydon, Sir Ben Kingsley. Hello, sir.
Toast of Croydon because of my wonderful performance as King Lear.
Absolutely.
No, it wasn't mine. It was Trevor's.
Trevor Slattery.
Trevor Slattery, who's a wonderful actor. But when I last saw Trevor, he was in rehab.
Oh, no.
Didn't recognise me. So I came in and I said, hi, Trevor. He looks at me. Sorry, am I talking about Trevor? It was Ben Kingsley. Anyway, Ben Kingsley came into my ward, my room, my chambers, and I said, I'm sorry, Ben, Lord Ben, but I don't recognise you. That's true.
Amazing.
Have you played King Lear?
When are you going to see your Lear, people say? And I say, I'm sorry, you're not going to.
Why do you not want to? Do you know, just don't want to do it? Don't want to touch it?
I'll do the movie.
One of the reasons I mentioned Trevor Slattery and Iron Man 3 in my opening there was because there's a line in Iron Man 3 that I think reflects on Robot Overlords, which is, some people call me a terrorist, I consider myself a teacher. Now, that's exactly a description that could apply to your character in this movie.
I think also that my character was very discontented with the world, with his universe, before the invasion. Mm-hmm. And tragically, we know from European history that many people who were savagely discontented with their own lives in their own countries had their problems solved by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. In other words, they collaborated. And we in the British Isles have no idea how horrible that must have been to choose which side you stand on or how you defend your family, how you defend your own integrity, your loyalty. It's a challenge that, thank God, and thanks to our own courage in World War II, we never had to face, other than the Channel Islands, of course. He has ceased to be a teacher. In other words, he's ceased to be a hander over of knowledge and wisdom. Mm. He's now just a warden,
yes,
a keeper of people. So that there is nothing in him that is any way educational or enlightening. He's just become a tool of the occupying forces. He wears an armband. He patrols the streets. And he is a kind of go-between between the occupying forces and the civilian population.
He's a character who seems very aware of the situation that he's in and very aware of the choices that he's making and the moral choices he's making. He's very afraid, it seems, of the word collaborators. I presume Robin Smythe is a character who's very much aware of history and of Nazi Germany and of Nazi sympathisers, and he doesn't necessarily want to be cast in that light.
I don't know whether in our robot world, World War II has or hasn't happened. I mean, it is a fictitious, completely fictitious landscape and environment. All I'm saying is that we can, as an audience and as a culture and as writers and directors, bring some kind of knowledge to our storytelling mm-hmm. that will ring true. And if you inject into a beautiful film like Robot Overlords, which is a vastly entertaining film involving teenagers and adults, a wonderfully successful family film, mm-hmm. it will be successful partly because, all I'm saying is, a lot of it is rooted in possible truths.
Yeah.
That you will have the dilemmas solved by very intelligent, valiant children who decide to understand or discover what makes the enemy tick rather than throw bombs at it. There is one course of action in a science fiction film where your goodies will bomb the baddies, and there's another version where your goodies will understand what makes the baddies work and dismantle it almost forensically and scientifically, which is what our young heroes do, and that's the difference. And I think that's going to be the strength of the film.
I spoke to John Wright, the director, a few months back, and he mentioned that Robin Smythe was based slightly on a teacher that you had.
Good, yes.
That's cool. Can you just explain who that was? Maybe not mentioning names, but exactly why this teacher ended up being an inspiration for you?
No, well, John, that's very generous of John. In fact, he's based on what I would call a composite of someone who has desperate social aspirations and will use any vehicle to empower himself. And my Smythe has chosen that path to elevate himself. So he has that streak of pretentiousness and pomposity that I never encountered at school amongst my teachers. They were gods.
All of them?
Oh, yes. On, Manchester Grammar School.
Okay.
Come on.
Yes, it's a prestigious and esteemed seat of learning, but everyone has one teacher that kind of got up their nose.
Robin Smythe apparently was a geography teacher. Mm-hmm. Guess what percent I got in my geography exam?
Can we say less than 80?
A lot lower.
Really?
7.
No. 7%?
Yes. And now I tread the world.
How did you get here?
As if it were my garden. Do I know where I am? Ask the 7%. Yes, the 7% knows where I am.
But if you did it now,
the 93,
though,
I haven't got a clue.
If you did it now, though, after all of your travels, you'd nail it.
I'd be better, yes.
Geography, to be fair, isn't just asking people where
I know that.
I do have a big Collins Atlas in at home in my little library, and I love looking at it. I love it. And borders, and I do a lot of films in Europe now, and in Czech Republic, and Slovakia and Romania, mm-hmm. and all these borders that have politically changed dramatically since 1900. It's unrecognizable.
Have you worked in Poland since Schindler's List?
No, I haven't.
You must have, I mean, because this has been the year of the anniversary of Auschwitz's liberation. It must have brought back.
I was in Prague for the 70th anniversary of the remembrance of the Holocaust with Moshe and Cantor and all the great Jewish elders of Europe. And we all went the next day to Theresienstadt concentration camp, where I gave a reading as I did the day before and was amongst some extraordinary people. An absolutely unforgettable period of my life to be associated with the Jewish people as their storyteller. They have embraced me and claimed me as a storyteller, and I find it an immense privilege that they have trusted me with that indelible but never to be understood piece of history.
It's a mighty film. Is it a film that you've revisited yourself in recent times, or is it?
I haven't seen it recently. I've seen clips of it, of course. Mm-hmm. A quotation from it. Actually, when I was in the Canary Islands, of all places, one of the young members of the staff of the hotel, as I was leaving the hotel, filming for Ridley Scott, Exodus for Sir Ridley, as I was leaving the hotel, a young member of staff stood in front of me in tears and said to me, "The list is life. The list is an absolute good." And I finished the couplet by saying, "On all around its edges lies the gulf." And this young person just burst into tears and waved me goodbye. Canary Islands. Wow. That couplet by that beautiful writer, Stephen Zalian, has become rather like Gandhi's an eye for an eye only ends up making the whole world blind. Mm. That couplet has become indelible in people's consciousness as a piece of truth, yeah. poetic truth. Mm. And to have collectively accomplished that as a filmmaker, my contribution to Stephen's film, to have that line remembered is really something.
Do you tend to remember? You said it's indelible, that's indelible for other people, but do you remember
lines? I mean, the historical act yeah. of the Holocaust is indelible.
Yeah. Mm. But also that couplet and other couplets and other lines throughout your career, do you remember things like that? Because I remember
them if they have been carved on my heart by a genius director for all the right reasons, in the right place, under the right circumstances. Yes, I can. Mm. Yeah. Stop it, for God's sake, stop it. That's Gandhi shouting to the young Hindu extremists who want to kill Muslims.
Wow.
Yes, there are. Fantastic. There are snatches.
I'm interested in some of the character details of Robin Smythe. He has a handkerchief which he cradles and dabs occasionally. Mm. The bow tie, he's quite sort of fastidious in the way that he's done that. He's got a baseball cap.
It's fastidious exterior.
But it's just interesting in the way that you sort of craft those small character details, because I know that when you worked on Shutter Island
with
Scorsese, you introduced the idea that the character would be English and the pipe and some of the kind of the clothing of Englishness to that.
Right.
Were there other films, other character details that you've kind of brought do you turn up on set day one with those things that you've read through the script and you thought maybe this, maybe that will help and then work from there?
Well, I think what you're generously referring to has its basis in a really well-written script. Mm. And if one can recognize genuine patterns of human behavior in a beautifully written script, then you can start to externalize, and it's quite thrilling for my heroic hero, Don Logan, heroic villain, I should say. It was decided, and I know is very much party to this decision, that you open his wardrobe and all the shirts and all the trousers and all the shoes are exactly the same.
Yeah.
Because he needs a uniform. He was a man who was probably rejected by the SAS because he was too violent and decided to be his own crack regiment. And that's what he wants to form when he goes to the island. He wants Ray to form a crack regiment with him, and Ray won't.
Yeah.
Military, yes.
After that film came out, did you have a period when whenever you boarded a plane, people would sort of shift nervously?
No, I used to do it deliberately, didn't I? I used to scare people, didn't I? I used to look and say, what the fuck are you looking at? What are you looking at? I used to scare them, didn't I? I don't get on an airplane scare. I don't.
I imagine if I was on a plane and Sexy Beast was screening, and then I saw them,
but they
I
won't
saw
show
you, and you were doing the impression.
Come on, they will never show that on an airplane.
Well, they could beep out virtually the entire
movie. Crashes.
That's a good point.
A good point. Yeah, it'd be 3 minutes long. That's the authorized version.
It would be a silent movie.
Absolutely. You filmed Robot Overlords partly in my backyard. Not my actual backyard, that would be strange, but...
I loved filming there.
Yeah.
That film commission is brilliant.
Yeah, they're
brilliant. They're really good. In fact, I'm modestly producing films at the moment, and if one of my films get off the ground, I'm definitely filming it in Northern Ireland. I've already researched up in Northern Ireland in the shipbuilding yards and the naval training station. Is it called Raleigh? No, it's not Raleigh. It's the other one. But you have one in...
Harland and Wolff?
You have one in Belfast, yes. Okay. I love filming there. The crews were amazing. Yeah. The landscape's beautiful. It lent itself to our story beautifully. A lot of the extras, who non-speaking parts, were terrifically collaborative. Mm. Great enthusiasm. It was really a really happy memory of filming there.
Fantastic. And you mentioned you're producing. Are you producing anything that's coming up this year? Are you actively producing something?
We
right
hope
now?
To have something. I won't jinx anything, but we are hoping to have something filming in this autumn, and then a mini series perhaps next year. And also a low-budget film either this year or next year. So we may have, touch wood, three things out of our six films greenlit. So we're going to have to start acquiring other properties jolly fast.
Fantastic. And one thing I always like to ask is the origin of a production company name. Your production company is Lavender Pictures.
Yes.
Why did you call it Lavender Pictures?
Because my darling wife is Daniela Lavender.
Simple as that?
Yes.
Simple as that. Fantastic. It's been a pleasure. We could talk to you about your illustrious career all day long, but sadly time is against us. Well, we have to get you to the Apple Store.
Oh.
We're running late.
Church on time.
Believe me, we could talk for hours.
That was a great pleasure, gentlemen.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Hey, should we have some movie news?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Normally I have written down some movie news, but I didn't this week. So, hey, Ali's waving something at me. Ali, what have you got?
Thomas Newman, notorious composer of film music.
That guy won't stop composing films.
Replaces John Williams on Steven Spielberg's new movie, Bridge of Spies. Bridge of Spies is a movie that is... It was originally written by another writer, but it then got redrafted by the Coen brothers, Phil and Gary. And that's why it's exciting. It's about the Cold War. It's about this downed U2 pilot. Make the joke about Bono here. And Tom Hanks
is... lost the edge? And I've been mulling that one over for ages. Was it no,
good
move
luck
on.
With Adam Clayton Jr.
So yes, Tom Hanks is playing this lawyer who must, you know, deal with the Soviets in terms of getting him back, getting this pilot back. It's exciting. It's Steven Spielberg. It's not John Williams, who had, he announced, a minor illness, which has since sorted itself out. And he will be back for the BFG, which is great news, because I can see the BFG and John Williams going together very, very well. But in the meantime, it's Thomas Newman, who is brilliant, and I think is a very worthy replacement. This is the first time we've had a non-John Williams Spielberg movie since The Colour Purple without a U.
I have a question. If you've called it several times there a Spielberg movie, if John Williams doesn't compose it, is it really? Does that count? What does Ian Freer think about this?
Ian Freer took it quite well. I think, yeah, he was okay with it.
He pointed out that only one other movie, aside from The Colour Purple, has theatrically released movie, has not been scored by... Do you know what it is, Helen?
1941?
No.
No, I don't know.
Do you know?
The Twilight Zone, the movie.
That's right. His segment of The Twilight Zone, the movie, was not scored by John Williams, nor was Duel.
That's not theatrically released in the...
So, there we go. Very... interesting news. We wish Mr. Williams all the best, obviously. Seems like he's got over the minor illness. He's scoring Star Wars The Force Awakens as well. It's going to be interesting, I'll be honest. I've long wondered what a Steven Spielberg movie would feel like without John Williams. And I think I've said this on podcasts before, I'd be intrigued to see what it looked like recently if he doesn't go with Janusz Kaminski as the DP. But I believe that's not the case on Bridge of Spies. But, you know, Thomas Newman is very, very good. And I think he's one of those trivia questions, isn't he? He's one of the guys who's been nominated for loads of Oscars, but never actually won anything.
Well, maybe this will be his year, fingers crossed.
Indeed.
I hope he does go with Kaminski, because I think he's great at, you know, dark rooms with people talking and making that look really fascinating.
Newman's done the likes of Road to Perdition, The Green Mile, so he is, you know... Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
And, so he has Tom Hanks previous.
Yeah, he does. And he can write for that face.
Skyfall and Spectre as well. He's about to do Spectre. And I liked his score for Skyfall, actually. So he's very, very good. Very good indeed. Well done, him. Yes, Hell's Bells.
Hello, I have news of Preacher, a comic that you and I both like.
A comic I love. Let's get that right.
Okay, fair enough. It is, of course, headed slowly... to the screen. We've been told this before, but it does seem to be moving a little bit faster this time. So Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Sam Catlin, not to be confused with Claflin, are producing, and they have found their tulip. Ruth Negga, who's been in World War Z, 12 Years a Slave, but is probably best known to most of you right now for her role as Reyna in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., or if you're still in Season 1, the girl in the flowery dress. She's going to be playing the... basically, former girlfriend and traveling companion, I guess, of Custer. He is our hero. He is the preacher of the title who becomes infused with the power of Genesis, which is the offspring of an angel and a demon, which gives him a power equal to God himself. And he goes off to find out why the Almighty buggered off. Tulip is a very, very, very important character in that journey. It's basically a sort of a three-hander through the story. It's Custer, Tulip, and a vampire called Cassidy, who's turned in the middle of the Irish Rebellion of 1916, begorra.
An Irish vampire, yeah.
Irish vampire.
Irish vampire.
He's vampire-ish.
I don't know why my accent went really bad there. It was a terrible Irish accent, and I've been doing one for years anyway. That's
anyway,
a much better one.
So I think this is an interesting first piece in the puzzle. She's really good in S.H.I.E.L.D. She's played a lot of sort of different facets in that role. You know, she's been at one hand kind of seductive and very charming, and then on the other hand, quite terrifying. And I think that's probably something that Tulip has to have. She has to be really tough as well as as really, really kind of winsome. So yes. Full marks for that.
Intriguing casting indeed. I guess quite famously the model that Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon used for Tulip in the comic book was Cameron Diaz. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is very, very cool. This is the first bit of casting.
Yeah.
I'll be really intrigued to see who they get as Jesse Custer, and Cassidy is going to be the big one.
There's such a lot to the books. I mean, there's what, 9 in the series collected?
Well, 66 issues.
Yeah. They've got to trim that down. So I wonder how much of the really weird characters are going to be in there.
I would hope as many as possible, because that's, honestly, that's what gave Preacher for me its unique flavor. And this is one of those bits of casting that is going to be really, really interesting. If you want to root out online who the massive racists are, something like this is going to root
it's
people out.
It's always good, yeah.
So anyone who has a problem with this, come and see me after class. Yeah, she's very, very good. So that's good casting indeed. Anything else?
A couple of quick little things. Emma Thompson and Kevin Kline have joined this live-action Beauty and the Beast. Mm. So Emma Thompson, I mean, obviously you think her and you think, ooh, isn't she great? I'd love to have a nice cup of tea with her, which is perfect because she's playing Mrs. Potts, who, of course, in the Disney version was a teapot.
Segway to go,
Helen. Yes, I'll just go, shall I? And then Kevin Kline will be voicing... I don't even know.
Belle's dad.
Belle's dad.
Who is the insane inventor contraption man.
So basically, it's kind of the role he played in Wild Wild West, just ooh, aged up a few years. Ugh. Like eccentric inventor.
Yes, with big cash.
Yeah.
But if he's in this, does that mean that Las Vegas 2 has been put on hold?
Surely he can do both. We wouldn't want to see Las Vegas 2 put back.
We wouldn't.
Well, you know, because then you wouldn't be able to do it.
I'm not even sure it's been announced.
No. Anyway, this is obviously the film that stars Emma Watson as Belle, Dan Stevens as the Beast,
Empire Spirit
Evans,
Animal.
Yes, indeed. Luke Evans as the awful Gaston.
Ruddy bloody Gaston, isn't it?
And Josh Gad as LeFou, who's Gaston's sidekick.
Genius casting there. They do actually all quite resemble, I'd say. It's not quite right because, you know, teapots, but they do all fit in for me. None of these do I go, oh, God, that's an awful... That's a real leap.
Mm.
But I think having a spirit animal, Dan Stevens, as the Beast is brilliant. Also, when he announced it on Twitter, he said... He found a picture that said engaging beast mode, or beast mode enabled, and he tweeted that, and that's now got thousands and thousands of retweets. Quite right, too.
Mm. Absolutely. I'm excited about this one.
Yeah?
I think it's going to be good.
Awesome.
I think it's going to be good. Cool.
And finally, very quickly, Flash Gordon is in development, apparently, at Fox, and is apparently going to be a sequel.
Oh.
According to original star, you've seen him in Ted, Sam Jones. So, yeah, a sequel. I mean, obviously, they set it up at the end of the last one. I can only hope that they do a sequel and they bring back Brian Blessed.
Could they get Luke Evans to play you-know-who and say, a bloody... bastards.
You bloody bastards.
Luke Evans would be a really, really good Timothy Dalton in that movie. He looks great in green, as we know from my sketchbook. And I think a sequel is insane, but then again, going back to Flash Gordon's insane.
Everything about Flash Gordon should be insane.
I want Flash Gordon to have a crossover with Fast and Furious, because then we've got a movie going on.
Who should write the score? I mean, obviously, the last time we had all the songs by Queen, who is the modern-day equivalent?
Queen, Helen, they're still going, but with Adam Lambert as their lead singer at the moment.
And actually, my brother went to a concert and said it was amazing, but...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But who is the modern-day equivalent?
You two.
You two.
I was probably not going to say that, but sure, okay.
That'd be good-ish. Muse are the new Queen, aren't they?
Are they?
Aren't they?
No, I want somebody a bit more fun.
Very theatrical and over the top.
Yeah, theatrical, yes, but maybe a bit more fun.
Rihanna?
A bit more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rihanna.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get back to her in a bit.
My knowledge of modern chart music, what the kids are listening to these days, is not as good as it used to be. But I imagine someone like JZ or
Beyonce,
someone like that would be very, very good indeed. I've got a little bit of news. You just can't monopolize the news, you guys. Sorry. I've got some actors have joined The Huntsman, which for a project that really nobody's demanding has got a cracking cast.
I think this is our pet project.
Isn't it? Oh, and we should talk about Steve Jobs and the fact that Phil's not here, but we should talk about that very, very briefly. So previously on The Huntsman, we've got Chris Hemsworth.
Yes.
We've got Emily Blunt.
Yes.
We've got Charlize Theron.
Woo!
Right? We have Jessica Chastain.
Excellent.
Right? They have now been joined. Nick Frost is returning as one of the dwarfs.
Excellent.
He played one of the dwarfs in the last film. And
one of the eight dwarves, yes.
And his character's name was...
Neon. Nyon?
Back by contractual demand.
Oh, don't...
Cynic.
Also, joining him as dwarfs in this one, Rob Brydon.
Is he a dwarf?
He'll be a dwarf, yes.
Gosh.
He'll be a dwarf, and you'll know him. He'll be the one doing the Tom Jones impression, and then going, Alexandra Roach.
Interesting.
Yeah, also, so it's two Cuban Fury stars as dwarfs.
And they're both Welsh.
They're both Welsh. Nick Frost's Welsh. Oh, Rob Brydon's Welsh, yes, good. Very good. Nick Frost and Rob Brydon play golf together.
My mind is blown. Wait, no, it's okay.
Sheridan Smith. Sheridan Smith will also be a dwarf in this one.
Okay.
So that's cool. This is a hella good cast. Well done, them. And the last thing we should talk about, if you've nothing to say about that, is the Steve Jobs thing. Because Phil's not here. Steve Jobs, the Danny Boyle, Michael Fassbender, Aaron Sorkin scripted movie about the Apple bloke. It's kind of Phil's thing, isn't it? You know, he's always banging on about it. And this week they he didn't release. This week there was a poster that someone had taken a snap off. I think it was at some convention. And there was a poster of Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs on top of the Next, which is a computer that he brought out in the 80s, and it died in his arse, but paved the way for the iMac and all these other things that didn't die in their arse. But the interesting thing, have you guys seen this? And Michael Fassbender in this image looks nothing like Steve Jobs.
They've done that thing where they go, right, so does he look a bit like Steve Jobs? I kind of, maybe, okay. Are we going to make an effort to really actually make him look like Steve Jobs? No. So given that, fuck it.
Yep.
Yep.
But I like that.
I like that approach. I actually don't mean that as an insult. I truly think an actor can act as someone and not look like them.
Yeah.
You're playing a character. You don't watch... I mean, all the Shakespeare plays that have kings in them, you don't go, well, I don't really believe you as Henry VIII, one of the better Shakespeare plays, because you don't look like him. No, you just... It's theatrics. Drama.
Yes.
Acting.
Act, dear boy.
Sir Ian.
Sir Ian. And then Michael Fassbender plays me as a young man.
They put me through the CGI mangle.
So, do I play an old Steve Jobs in this movie or what? That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
No.
No, okay, let's move on then. Let's have a second guest, shall we?
Let's do it.
Shall we? Let's do that. Our second guest this week is also one of the greatest actors on the planet and one of the greatest humanitarians on the planet. He has two Oscars to show for the acting part.
No Oscars for the humanitarian part, none.
But a sense of self-worth, I think, which is incalculable. He is, of course, Sean Penn, who's taken a detour from the usually very intense... I'll do it again. He is, of course, Sean Penn, who's taken a detour from the usually very worthy, intense fare that drives him to have a little bit of Jerry action fun in this week's The Gunman. He spoke to Phil recently when he was in London.
Can I just say?
Yes.
He just starts talking in this interview. He gets going. He's talking about the film.
Sean Penn,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's by the Taken director who is...
It's Pierre Morel. Yes.
Yes, there you go. So he's talking about that straight off. So I'm sorry if it's a bit abrupt, but there you go.
You know, one of the interesting things to me about it is that we've gotten to a point, and I don't know how new an idea this is, but we're recognizing it more, where there is very little military action that doesn't a naval military reaction in ways that were unanticipated. And so this seemed like a kind of setup to discuss that in the form of a kind of high-octane movie, and that excited me. So what the world of that is, all of the aspects having to do with what you bring up, the world of private contractors, otherwise known as war without oversight.
Right.
War without accountability. These are very current themes that we're seeing much more today than we've ever seen them before.
Yeah.
And we're experiencing the ramifications of it.
You mentioned it's got some action sequences, and one really stood out for me. It's got a cracking scene in set in Spain in the countryside in this amazing kind of villa, and Javier Bardem's character, obviously, without giving away who he is, and it ends up with you and Jim Terrier and the lady he's trying to protect in a bathroom, which the bad guys have poured petrol under the door of and setting the place on fire. It's a hell of a scene. How was that to film? Just wondered if it brought back any memories of State of Grace, because you had a similar...
It did. The conversations came up.
Did they?
I in State of Grace... Well, yeah, the answer to your question, and the short answer is it was hot. Walls of fire are very hot. More so in State of Grace, because we actually went through it. In this case, it was more around us. But I was led by my very... courageous leading actress Jasmine,
who yeah.
was unfearful of anything,
really,
and such a trooper. So we just played around in the fire.
It is kind of like the opposite of the scene in State of Grace. For people that haven't seen it, that's you and Gary Oldman. Mm. You light a cigarette, drop it into the petrol, and then basically run through the flames, which you guys did for real. Mm-hmm. And when Gary Oldman came on into the Empire, did a web chat, someone asked him about that, and he said, basically like, what were we thinking?
Yeah. Well, I remember
Gary
lost a little bit of eyebrow there. I was, as I remember it, Gary... trying to remember who ran out first, who broke the wall first. In either case, it left him in the more vulnerable situation that way. But I know the concern was that if whoever it was, and like I said, I don't remember whether it was he or I that hit the wall of fire first, but if that person fell down and tripped up the second one in the fire, it would have been very unpleasant. But I do remember that despite the gel... Gary had some singeing.
That's amazing. Did that create any unusual continuity errors with like one eyebrow or Gary Oldman
in
the next scene?
No, I don't think it got that bad. I would just say that he smelled a bit like a dentist's office, burned bone.
That's a weird image, a weird olfactory image. You are in, without blowing smoke, phenomenal shape in this movie. I don't know, have you been in better shape in a film before? Ray Winston put it this way. He said, he said, you have an 8-pack and he has a party pack.
Ray Winston, I love that guy. He's a great actor and great guy. I think I probably spent most of my career getting out of shape for films.
Yeah, right.
Just based on the kind of characters. But there was a lot of physicality in this thing and then just, you know, preparing for it. You erred on the side of fitness, yeah.
Yeah. I guess people are going to say, oh, Sean Penn could be born again as an action star. I just wondered, I mean, without getting into all of that stuff, because you've given me a wry grin, was it fun? Is it fun to do this stuff? Because Pierre Morel has a real ken for an action sequence.
Yeah, he's very good. When you're dealing with, you know, emotional realities and exchanges in dialogue, there is... more margin for error in pursuit of it. And I think sometimes that can make, depending on who you're working with, it can make for lazy circumstances. If there's anything that I really liked about doing some of the more action-involved sequences, it was there wasn't much margin for error without, you know, and I'm talking about basically, you know, somebody hurting somebody, breaking somebody's nose or something, with the physicality of it. You're working with another performer in very specific ways, and I like that. You know, I like it in scene playing.
Yeah, there's not so much room for, I guess, a happy accident if you're doing an action sequence of like close combat in this.
Well, you know, except that, you know, happy accidents in these things are when somebody gets hurt. If they're not,
exactly.
If they're not too badly hurt, because you get a very realistic hit.
Did you get hurt?
I got hurt a couple of times. You know, it was physical enough that all of us took a little bit of a banging here and there. But the actors who I worked with in the scenes were very, very good.
Yeah.
And many of whom had a fair amount of martial arts experience and stunt experience in the past. So nothing devastating happened.
You'd be really reaching to think that Jim Terrier and Jeff Spicoli could ever sit down and have a good chat, but they do both love surfing.
There's that.
There is that. So there's one thing they could bond over. Obviously, Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High is kind of a cult hero. Do people still come and want to chat to you about him? Is he a character that people kind of come up to you in the street and want to...
It comes up sometimes. But it's enough years ago that... I couldn't say how aware I am of how many generations it's jumped and people are aware of it still or not. But I guess it's kept some legs, and I hear about it sometimes.
Have you revisited the film in recent years? I mean, was something you're going to sit your kids down with?
I saw most of it when it played. I think it was on regular television. And so it had censored areas and things like that. But I think I saw it with my kids at some point. They were watching it, maybe 15 years ago.
Really? Probably. What did they say? Did they love it?
I think they liked it. I think so, as I remember. But I'm not, it's a little bit of a vague memory.
A film that we love at Empire very much is Carlito's Way. I can't not ask you about the look of that character, and especially the hair. Can you just tell me, explain a little bit about how you came to style him in that way? Because you shaved and you shave back into the hair and then have a kind of a perm on top behind.
Yeah, I had gone into look magazines of the period and found a big portrait of a young lawyer from the period in which the book was based. And it just struck me that this seemed like the look of the guy that I had read in the screenplay. So I started playing with it and cutting the hairline back and so on, and then shaving back inside to thin the hair in the back and the crown, and then got it permed.
Yeah.
And then the chemicals of the perm kind of made turn my hair into a kind of like a dark orange. That I liked once it happened,
right.
So I didn't end up using any color on it.
Yeah.
And it sort of fit what I, you know, the picture that I had in mind, and there we were.
When you were away from the set, were you getting some unusual looks from nearest and dearest? And
it's not a hairstyle I recommend somebody in their 30s, in New York for 4 months of shooting with, no.
I came across a quote about your mum when she watched your first play. And she said, well, you were just awful. You've got to have something to fall back on, which is, I think, something my mum would say. Do you remember what the role was?
Yes, it was a stage performance. It had been adapted in reverse of the norm from film to stage. What had been a John Frankenheimer movie, The Young Savages.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So that's big. That's pretty heavy material, I guess. Did you ever have like a fallback if at that point in your mind at all?
By the time I was 19 or 20, I had gotten somewhat established in the theater in Los Angeles. And by established in the theater, I don't mean I was getting paid, because it was waiver theater. But I knew that I would be able to work as an actor. And by, again, not necessarily being paid, I would find other jobs to support it. But I saw myself very happily continuing doing that well into my 40s, when I thought I would, at that point, have a movie career. And the reason I thought of it that way was because there weren't, in 1978, 79, 80, there were not a lot of movies made with significant roles for young actors. There had been historically, you know, the James Dean High School, all of that period. But then for all of my time growing up, most of the leading actors in movies were a little bit older. And so I saw any opportunity to work significantly in film as coming much later. So my master plan was to work on the loading docks for Roadway Express to support my acting habit in Waver Theater, and that I'd be perfectly content to do that till about the age of 40 when I would go on to start working in film.
And your master plan now? Because you're back directing again. It's your first since Into the Wild, which is a beautiful movie. It's been a bit of a, I guess, what, 8 years between?
Yeah, it's always been a long time between movies that I've directed, because it's very difficult for me to find that thing that I'm ready to commit years of my life to, which is what the directing job is.
Yeah. We're in a time where cinema is moving in a direction towards a lot of like big blockbuster properties. They seem to be the safest things for Hollywood studios. And, you know, smaller, interesting movies as well. Have you been offered any of those superhero parts? Have you ever been sent those? Do you ever sit down with them and have a think that that's something you might want to do or find a place in that world? Is that something that interests you at all?
I have typically, I have been talked to about some of those things. I have sussed out what it would mean to me to be on location, looking at a ceiling, going to bed at night, asking myself exactly what I was doing there. And I was able to then, in the second column, put the answer to what number I would need to be paid to do it. And in each case, have I outpriced myself.
Really? By a big number or
by
a small number?
By a substantial.
I have to wrap up shortly, but another quick question that's a little bit random, but Being John Malkovich is another film that is beloved. You play obviously a slightly smaller part in that, you cameo. I think it's only a thanks credit on your IMDb page, but you play yourself talking about how you were inspired by Malkovich's puppeteering career, and it's kind of hilarious. How did that come about for you? What are your memories of doing that?
It's just, I got a call from Spike.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he is among the few very original directors out there, and a person easy to say yes to and hard to say no to. And so I came down and did it.
Did he explain what the film was?
He explained a little bit. He explained a little bit. I was anxious to be surprised when I saw it in the theater, so I didn't read a screenplay or anything like that.
No.
I just came down and did that bit.
You didn't say, why can't it be Being Sean Penn? John Malkovich can cameo in my movie.
No, I was interested in a movie called Being John Malkovich. I'm still interested. I'd like to see a sequel.
Still Being John Malkovich. Sean Penn, thank you very much for joining us on the Empire Podcast.
Thanks.
Lots of films to get through this week. We're going to get on to The Gunman later on. Let's start with Helen. Where should we start?
Should we start with The Voices?
Should we start with The Voices?
I've been hearing The Voices, so
we had Gemma Arterton on last week.
We did have Gemma Arterton on last week. We do like this film. Let's get one of the good ones out of the way this week. Okay, let's do it.
So this is the story of Jerry, who's played by Ryan Reynolds, who is a small town guy. He works as a shipping sort of coordinator in a factory that makes bathtubs and toilets and things. And he has a bit of a crush on Gemma Arterton's character, who works in the accounts department and is, you know, terribly exotic and loud and everything. He thinks she's wonderful. The problem is, after some traumatic events in his childhood that we won't talk too much about because it sort of becomes apparent during the film, he is a little bit, let's say, mentally fragile, and he really should be taking his medication, and he really isn't taking his medication because it makes him feel a little bit down. So instead he's sort of hearing voices, principally embodied by his cat and dog. His cat seems like a force for maybe evil, and his dog is, you know, somewhat more reassuring. But things get a little bit out of Jerry's control, and unfortunate things happen. And what we essentially have here is kind of a serial killer rom-com, sort of. It's really quite disturbing, and yet sometimes almost charming, and that makes it even more disturbing. Mm. It's a very odd mix. You also have Anna Kendrick in the cast there as well, who I should mention, and Jackie Weaver. It's a really good cast all round. It's directed by Marjane Satrapi, who, of course, broke through with Persepolis. This is about as far from that as it is possible to get. This is her definitely not going to be stereotyped as a director. But it is odd. I do want people to know that going in. You should know that. Be prepared for something. You haven't quite seen anything quite like this, which is a good thing. It doesn't always 100% feel like it works, to be honest. The tone is a little bit, it does shift a bit. But what I think is really good about this is it keeps you guessing. And actually, if you go back and watch it again, because I've seen this twice now, it hangs together a lot better the second time, and it feels even sadder the second time.
Yeah.
But yeah, really, it's an interesting and quite a brave film, and unlike anything else out there.
3 stars for The Voices.
Yes.
Sounds like for some people it might be more of a 4. But then again, for some people it might be more of a 2.
Yeah, I think it is going to divide people. I think you're either going to love it or hate it, to coin a cliche. But not always as funny as you maybe want it to be. But I think that's because there's a lot of drama hidden under the surface there. So, yeah.
It's carved up the opinions of a lot of people I know. Annoyingly, one person just said, "Yes, right." And I just like, oh, well, no, my thesis has gone wrong.
Weirdo.
It's all right.
Oh, I quite like the bit when the cat talked. Didn't like it when the dog talked.
No. Well, you're either a dog person or a cat person.
It's true.
3 stars then for The Voices. Let's move on next to, I guess this is the big release of the week, which is the Divergent series, colon, Insurgent. Now, previously in the Divergent series...
Some stuff happened.
Something happened?
Yes.
To one of the characters.
I'm sure it did, because it did take 2.5 hours. So something, I think,
yes,
must have happened.
Yes. Because the
lady... Let me enlighten you guys.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so for some reason, we're in Chicago in the future. The city is walled, and there's been some kind of apocalypse, so pretty much everybody else seems to be dead, and people are living in Chicago. And they're divided into 5 factions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why. It doesn't make any sense, and it will be explained apparently in the 3rd book, which is spread across 2 films, inevitably.
No. Really?
Yes, I'll be honest, I've read the 3rd book, and it still doesn't make sense, but whatever.
Okay.
They're divided into factions. Triss, who's a young girl, played by Shailene Woodley.
Oh, yeah, okay.
No, very easy
That's
mistake to
one.
Make, Chris.
Okay.
Yep. She discovers, when she's tested to find out which faculty she's most suited for, that she is actually divergent, which is that she has equal capacity for several different factions. And for some obscure reason, and it still doesn't make any sense to me after 2 films, this makes her a threat to the system. This is a particular problem for Kate Winslet's Janine, who is the leader of the erudite or intelligence faction, who is trying to kind of control the whole lot. But Triss, at the end of the first film, it turned out at the end of the first film that Janine was using a sort of computer simulation to control people, to essentially brainwash people, and that divergents were resistant to this program. So I guess that's one reason she's a threat, but it still doesn't make any sense. Anyway, Triss is on the run with her boyfriend, Theo James, a.k.a. 4, and in this film, Janine gets hold of some artifact and they have to go get it. That's it.
I've also seen this film, and I walked out going, it's better than the first one. I also am in no way sure of what happened. I needed someone like Helen maybe to explain it to me. It is a film that has, well, this is like this because of this, and you can't forget that, and then there's this group and there's that group, and it's a lot of people running after each other, running towards a thing, running behind a thing, people suddenly arrive out of nowhere, there's sci-fi, it's both apocalyptic and everything's kind of gone to seed, and yet there's also lots of really hyper super tech, and there are people living in kind of grit and dirt and trying to make something out of nothing, people who are factionless, there's like kind of a super hobo group. I'm being very childish here.
Yeah, led by Naomi Watts, looking exactly like Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow. Bizarre.
That's true. There is a similarity there. I just found it... convoluted isn't quite right, maybe. I just found it very busy.
Yeah.
And though I enjoyed it, it wasn't great.
Here's the problem with this whole series, and this goes for The Maze Runner, which has exactly the same problem. If your entire premise is a mystery, it's really hard for us to care about your plot. So the more time you spend on your plot, the less we like your film.
Mm-hmm.
If we love your characters, we'll let you away with it. And certainly, you know, at the premiere, there were a whole lot of fans who absolutely love Triss. And so they're going to have a good time, I guess. But if you aren't giving us the satisfaction of knowing how your plot actually functions, then we have to absolutely adore the people it's happening to, or there's nothing to connect with there. And, you know, Woodley just about kept me on board this, but it was by the skin of her, you know, my teeth or her teeth or somebody's teeth. It's really touch and go as to whether you're actually going to get into this. I mean, it's well put together, and I think they've made every effort to try and, you know, differentiate the factions through design and through color and everything else. They're doing everything right. I think the problem is just with the source, it makes a mystery of its own ethos, and therefore it's really hard to get into.
So which Hemsworth brother's in this one?
This is
Joel?
Theo James Hemsworth. That's his middle name.
He's very good. I like Theo James a lot. I feel like everyone who's acting in this film is a bit better than this film.
Probably fair. Yeah.
Well, Miles Teller's in this film.
Yeah,
he's really good.
He's having fun. He's the only person on screen who visibly enjoys himself at any point.
And this is a guy who said about the first film, I did it for the paycheck. I wanted to get some I want to be more known to by the public. And knowing that there's a story of Miles Teller being approached in the street and someone's shouting, "Hey, Whiplash!" I said, I was interviewing the two of them, the leads. Do you ever get that in the street? Do you ever get "Hey, Divergent"? It's like, yes, I got it the other day. Someone walked up to me and just shouted, "Divergent!" What's the response to that one? Yeah, I was in that.
You have correctly identified me, sir. Now have an apple and please leave.
Busted.
This is directed by Robert Schwentke, who, of course, is the visionary behind RIPD, Red, and Flight Plan. Taken over from Neil Berger. How does Schwentke stack up?
I honestly think they're doing everything right in the execution of this film. I think, they have done everything possible to make it make sense. I think they're, genuinely.
Yeah, the special effects look good.
That sounds really dabbing with faint praise.
It really does.
And they take complicated stuff and make it work.
But
it doesn't work very well.
Yeah. I honestly, no criticism whatsoever for the direction, for the effects. The effects are great here. There's a couple of really gorgeous sequences in these kind of simulations which allow them to do crazy, wonderful stuff. And again, I think the cast, like you say, they're better than the film, but that actually helps a lot because Woodley almost single-handedly keeps us going through. I mean, she gets hardly any scenes really with four. He's good as far as he's there.
That's Theo James.
But, Everybody's good. Everybody's doing well. My problem is just the story doesn't work for me.
Well, Helen, I, for one, am excited about seeing Allegiant Part 1 in 2016 and Allegiant Part 2 in 2017. Allegiant Part 1, as you know, will be the first Divergent series movie to have the character Kara in it, played by Alicia Hang.
Which is exciting.
It's very exciting. And I can't wait to see the further adventures of Beatrice Pryor and Tobias Eaton unfold on the big screen.
Look at you knowing stuff.
Look at me on the IMDb.
3 stars for that one.
3 stars for the Divergent series :Insurgent. Next up, should we talk about the gunman?
Yes. Superhero extraordinaire, gunman, is the one man in the world who can shoot a gun.
Bitten by a radioactive gun, Jim Terrier turns into the gunman.
Sean Penn, blessed with a power he does not want, is busy doing humanitarian stuff. When his hands turn to guns. No, actually, this is a little bit odd, but let's just read out the official plot here.
Okay.
The past catches up with retired hitman Jim Terrier when a trio of killers turn up to interrupt his humanitarian work in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Escaping with his life, Terrier reluctantly takes up arms once more to smoke out his assailants.
This sounds like a Sean Penn documentary that someone's just released.
That went horribly right.
Yes.
It's got Javier Bardem in it, who is another very good actor, and though he is given quite, let's say, middling dialogue, there's a lot of good acting going on in this movie made by the director of Taken. Like, you might think of this as being a bit, oh, it's another Taken. And people already calling it, obviously, Sean Penn does Taken. But it's much more of a traditional kind of, let's be honest, subpar Ludlum-type thriller where the person who's going to betray you may or may not be right in front of you type thing. And while it doesn't reinvent the wheel, Sean Penn is a fantastic actor and he sells this whilst looking like an absolute buff ting. He is built. He looks great. He has guns for arms now. He looks great and he takes out the guys efficiently. There's some nice set pieces going on here, but really, it's not much we haven't seen before. It will make you long for Bourne. You might even think, oh, I'm going to go home and watch Bourne after you finish watching it. But really, Taken is probably a more enjoyable prospect, and if this isn't going for out-and-out, enjoyment, fun factor, it needs to deliver on the plot thinky side, and it doesn't quite do that. In fact, its plot is rather basic, and it delivers its plot in a kind of unclear way, as if to disguise that it's actually quite simple.
What a cast, though.
What a cast.
What a cast. You got Ray Winston's floating head. You have...
Ray Winston's great.
Mark Rylance as the BFG, or is he saving that for the actual film?
No, he's playing a wolf.
Okay. Javier Bardem, as you mentioned, Big Driss, Idris Elba's in this one as well. It's a hell of a cast. And, you know, for that alone, it's enjoyable watching these guys.
Of course, yeah.
Butt heads and...
It's, you know, it's stylishly executed. Yeah. It's a good-looking thing, and it works. It's just not as good as it possibly could have been. And, you know, like you say, the acting is great.
Given that Pierre Morel's first film I've taken was The Execrable From Paris With Love...
Which you and I, Chris, adored watching together in a very lonely...
Yes.
Screening room.
Yes.
I had to go in a completely different direction, but we spent 20 minutes walking to your bus stop just ranting. That is maybe the most like conventionally publicly racist film I've seen in a long time.
It's extraordinary, that film. Yeah. It's absolutely terrible. But it's good to see Pierre Morel back on track with with this. To an extent, 3 stars for The Gunman.
Yeah.
And it is fine at the bang bang shooty stuff. Should we talk about Home? We had Jim Parsons on the podcast last week. And this is DreamWorks Animation's latest movie in which he plays a very cute alien.
Called O.
Called O.
Now, Helen, I think you and I are going to have fun talking about this one.
Yep.
I review this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it, I think, as much as you did, Helen.
I liked it a lot.
I gave it a 2.
I think you're harsh.
I think I am being harsh, but I am spoiled by some very good animation, and I thought it just wasn't good enough. I'm going to try to explain the plot as simply as I can. There are a race of aliens, small, squishy, purple aliens, sometimes they're not purple, doesn't matter, that come from the space, out of space, they come to Earth because they want to invade it. They want to invade it, take it over. But the reason why is slightly forgivable-ish. It's because there is a big, bad alien race called the Gorg who are chasing them. And these guys, the Boov, the little squishy fellas, they are adorably cowardly. But what they do is they come with a super sci-fi spaceships and they come and take an Earth or an Earth-like planet, take it over, relocate all of the people who live in it into a barren area of the Earth. So in this case, they might go to, I don't know, Australia, the outback, and then they terraform it, then they put everyone in lovely houses. But in the meantime, they, the Boov, live in the other houses that there were. Okay, are we clear?
Yes.
This is all part of the movie.
Yes.
First 15-minute stuff. One human is not relocated, and that human is the young girl called Tip, who's played by Rihanna. Rihanna also does the music for this film. She is not relocated because she happens to have her cat, Pig, on her head, and the scanners read her as not human, so that's fine. Right, so Rihanna's character Tip, the teenage girl, and O, the socially alienated alien, who is kind of ostracized from the Boov. He is an accidental, flubby idiot that just falls over a lot, keeps saying the wrong thing, everyone thinks he's annoying. They become best mates-ish over the course of a road trip which takes them to Paris and other parts of the world inside a flying car that is powered by slushy machines. Think I've pretty much got it. Tip is looking for a mum who's played by Jennifer Lopez. They need to find out where she is and then get her back and also possibly stop another invasion of Earth. That is the plot of this children's movie. Helen, I'd like your thoughts.
I really enjoyed it. I think here's the thing that worked for me, and it's basically the characters. I thought that O was utterly adorable, and that his relationship with Tip just developed in some very cute directions, actually. They're kind of an odd couple who sort of find a nice balance between themselves. And I also find it very funny. I think it genuinely made me laugh out loud at times. Not always at O's grammar, but sometimes.
Yeah, can I come into the out now?
Can I come into the out now? Hmm. He's kind of, why for do you do this? That kind of thing. I just find him very, very charming, and that sort of made me, you know, put me on board with the film. I also find the design and so on of the aliens quite cool. The Boov used bubbles, sort of bubble based technology, which is kind of cute. I mean, because it's a really dark premise actually to be selling as a small kids movie. You know, aliens have taken over the world and chucked us all to the Australian outback, but the Boov are so cute and so clueless that they just about get away with it, which I think is actually quite a quietly impressive bit of filmmaking. So I just thought it was cute. It made me laugh, and I was heartwarmed by the end of it. Also, interesting side note, I read the book that this is based on, and O's character was originally called J-Lo because they had to choose human names, and he thought that would be a good one. But apparently there were rights issues, believe it or not, using the name J-Lo, even though J-Lo is in the film.
Also, that would just get so meta and confusing.
It really would.
It's directed by Tim Johnson, who did Ants, which I like a lot. Of course, that was based on something by this guy called Woody Allen, so I think that might have been the reason why I liked it more. Mm-hmm. And it was also obviously based on this book by a guy called Adam Rex,
yes,
which is called The True Meaning of Smeck Day.
Mm.
I think this movie is actually a bit of a curio. I think people might come back to it later on and go, actually, there's a little bit of bonkers magic to this. But I personally think it is flavourless, inoffensive, beigey, it'll do stuff. Steve Martin mugs the hell out of it. He plays the king of the booths, the...
Smack.
I described it in possibly the third Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference I've made so far this podcast. I gave the verdict of this film as mostly harmless. It is pretty much fine, but actually not good enough.
Two stars for home. A better animation that comes out this week is the latest from Studio Ghibli, The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. Helen.
Yes, this is, I mean, I liked Home a lot more than Ali did, but this is a far, far better film. Having now seen it, I actually have to confess, I saw this after the Oscars. Having now seen it, I think that Big Hero 6 and my beloved Baymax committed Grand Theft Oscar. This is an astonishing film, and honestly, the only explanation for it not winning the best Oscar is that not enough voters must have seen it, but it is utterly wonderful. So this is from Isao Takahata. Apologies for my pronunciation, who is the other co-founder of Studio Ghibli. And it's based on an old Japanese legend which had a bamboo cutter finding a tiny princess, sort of a couple of inches high, in a glowing bamboo stalk. And he took her home and she turned into a baby and grew up into this beautiful girl. Meanwhile, he cut open another bamboo and found treasure, found gold coins within, and found beautiful silks and robes and kimonos for her. So he basically decided she was obviously destined to be a princess. So he moves them to the big city. He sets them up in style. He has her take lessons in how to be a properly behaved Japanese lady, so that rich men will come to court her, which she has no interest in. And it's sort of, I don't want to say too much about the plot, but it goes on from there. It is astonishing, this animation. There is a scene where she runs out of a party that is the most gorgeous piece of animation I have seen in my entire life. It's basically sort of based on Japanese kind of watercolors and almost the kind of calligraphy brush strokes and the charcoal kind of colors that you see in Japanese classical art. But it is utterly gorgeous. I mean, sometimes he'll leave white space around the edge of the picture. He'll just kind of give you the impressionistic impression of the landscape and even of the character sometimes. But it works so, so beautifully. And it builds into this kind of almost religious folktale that I think there's a lot of stuff there for the adults that maybe kids watching it won't necessarily get. But I mean, on whatever level you watch it, this is one of the most gorgeous films that has ever been made. And I think, you know, it's a reminder that there is actually more to Studio Ghibli than the great Miyazaki, that Takahata is, you know, equally talented. He did Grave of the Fireflies, so, you know, which is one of the most moving cartoons I think ever made. This one I would put on the same level almost as that. It's stunning.
So it's good then?
A little bit good. Good.
4 stars for The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. Go and check it out if you can. I think it's a limited release this weekend. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast Cinematic Feast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by two more heavyweights and another knight.
Ooh.
In the shape of Antonio Banderas, who's not a knight, and Sir Kenneth Branagh, who is. That's a hell of a lineup. Good lineup. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to pick a pair of pickled
pumps.
Perspect pumps.
There you go.
Sorry about the popping. See you next week. Bye-bye.